speak. And then there's this concept that any number of separate parts, when brought together, create a new unity. And explore a little further the thinking of Pythagoras on this subject and possible applications in modern philosophy and in modern living. We decided that if we took six little sticks and brought them together, we no longer conceived them or considered them as six separate items. But we created the term six as a new compound symbolic definition. And this six was a unit, or a unity, composed of six parts. But we have, or did, establish the concept of a unity of consciousness for these parts. Now this introduces what Pythagoras calls the numerated soul. And he likened it to a quality in the universe, considering it to be a natural attribute of the divine geometrician, the great architect of the world, who designed all things according to number. The numerated soul is that mysterious intangible which comes in to ensoul or totalize groups of parts. Thus, the six single sticks are really separate things, but the concept of six is possible because of the numerative soul in the world, which creates out of all separate parts an indissolvable compound. It then ensouls this compound totally, bestowing unity. We have the same thought in the Bible, where the reference is made, if two or more are gathered together in my name, I am the midst of them. This gathering or totality results in the ensoulment of things by a composite being which becomes the factor of intelligible unity, causing these separate things to become oneness, or something that we can liken to an analogy. Supposing we have six fairly large pieces of wood. A carpenter comes along, and of these six pieces of wood, he fashions a chair. Now this chair is actually these six pieces of wood. And as they laid along in a row, there's no concept of a chair. Yet when certainly joined, according to the skill of the carpenter, they become a chair. Where are the six sticks of wood in the concept of chair? And where is the chair in the concept of the six separate sticks of wood? Something has happened. And out of these pieces of wood, perhaps not especially useful in their original condition, has been created a new thing. A thing which has a name and a meaning, totally different from the individual pieces of wood. Yet it is composed of them plus one thing, the ordering power of the carpenter's mind. Therefore, in the universe, all things are composed of separate parts plus the organizing power of the divine intellect. Man is a series of elements, of heterogeneous parts and members, which have neither integration nor organization, is separated from the builder that inhabits them. Therefore, at death, there is a decomposition of the body, which is merely the resurrection. dissolution of part back into a native substance. And the power which takes the body, made up of innumerable monads, or separate units, and fashions it into a compound capable of sustaining the life of the individual and advancing his various physical, emotional, and mental activities. This compound is composed of parts plus an organizing mind. And this organizing mind, inanimate things, we call a spiritual being. In inanimate things, Pythagoras called it the nutritive soul, inasmuch as it was a quality of life which ensouls forms or parts. And Pythagoras carries this concept further in maintaining that as man variously extended his faculties and powers, adding to the totality of himself through growth, he immediately became a new unit and was installed by a new numerative power. Thus an individual who possessed three arts and sciences has a unity composed of these three as a rational being. But if through study he develops two more arts and sciences so that he is fairly the master of them, then he has a numerative power of knowledge to the unit of five, and he himself as a total being is changed. If therefore, to the six pieces of wood, he added three more, the numerative soul of six vanishes, disappears, returns to archetypal dimension, and the numerative soul of nine takes over with a new unit consciousness. The same is true in all the things that men do, for all forms in nature are aggregations of monads plus the principle of a numerative soul, which measures their qualities by their number. Number having a strange and mysterious power, which we know today in science, frequently comes to our assistance in estimating, for example, the basic atoms or electrons in various elements, determining the nature of the elements by the number of its monadic parts. Also, we determine sound by the number of its vibrations. We determine color by the number of its vibrations. And all things are therefore, in this way, enumerative, or built upon the concept and principle of number. If to a certain color we add another tone, we change the whole of the color, creating a new color composed of a certain number of separate color monads. And for this new color we have a name. When we mix yellow and red together, we have a new name for it, orange. An orange is neither yellow nor red. It is a new color, a new concept, and is one of those examples which Pythagoras pointed out, namely that the geometrician of the universe abhors divided natures, and wherever two divided parts are brought together in any kind of an arrangement, a principle of unity, or an aspect of the numerative soul takes over, creating always unity, creating always a new oneness, a oneness composed of parts. Therefore, we take hydrogen and oxygen, and we combine them, and we produce a new unity, which we call water. And in water, the mysteries of the hydrogen and oxygen are mysteriously hidden. We no longer recognize two parts of hydrogen and one part of oxygen. We recognize only water. So water, again, on the level of elements, is a compound produced by the numerative soul, which embodies or empowers totality, and creates out of all combinations a new and complete unification. Now this brings us then to the next one of these Pythagorean theorems, and that is the affirmative negational numbers and the negative affirmative numbers. Now this is a rather intriguing thought, because we can immediately get to a concept of something. Following the idea that one is unity, totality, and affirming what we have always held as ordinary thinkers, that God is one, and that God is totality. Therefore, we have the power to say God is one. This is an affirmative statement. This is therefore a pure affirmation, which means a positive statement of conviction, which is an affirmation. Always, therefore, unities of all kinds permit a positive affirmation. This is orange. This is God. This is a chair. These become positive. And therefore, all unities create the power of a positive statement of themselves, or an affirmative statement of totality. We have also heard, as I told you last week, that the Pythagoreans regarded the number two as a negative number. Therefore, representing as it does in the universe the principle of diversity, it signifies parts to which we have not attained the concept of totality. Therefore, if we wish to use the numbers to define God, we must use a negative affirmative, for we must say God is one, which is a positive affirmative, but we must say God is not two, because we cannot assume division in the divine nature. We can therefore, in thinking of any number of parts, and using these parts, or any fragmentary existence in nature, in an effort to define divinity or first cause, we must always say in the negative. God is unlimited. God is not limited. We cannot say God is this part or that part. Therefore, we must say that deity is not this part or that part, but God is the sum of parts. Therefore, wherever the concept of numeration or totality come in, we can make positive statements of fact. But wherever we have division, and the reconciling or unifying or numerative soul has not bound them into a concept, they represent imperfection. And when we attempt to define the perfect, we may say it is either perfect, or we may say it is not imperfect. And when we say that it is not imperfect, we are then negatively stating that it is perfect. So wherever we observe phenomena, which is the observation of divided parts, we must say this is not totality. But wherever we preserve or perceive unity, we may say this is totality. Therefore, everywhere in nature, even on the lowest level of symbolism, whatever unities exist are elevated above disunity. And if of a number of things we must choose one to symbolize deity, we must naturally choose that in which there is the least diversity or the greatest unity. Pythagoras affirming then that this is true, pointed out that the experience of God in the universe of divided parts is bestowed by the numerative power in the human soul, which is capable of the experience of at least the theoretical understanding of unity, so that man from himself bestows unity upon those parts which appear divided. And if he is capable of bestowing unity, he is then said by both the Pythagoreans and the Platonists to have achieved the intellective power. For the intellective power in man is the power from within himself conceive a non-apparent but nevertheless real unity. In other words, the individual lives among strangers. And while he lives in a world of strangers, it means that the numerative soul within himself is inoperative. But when he comes to the conviction that these strangers are his brothers, that there is only one humanity, he may not see it. He may not be able to demonstrate it physically, but he has experienced it by the virtue of the numerative power within himself, which is the power to transcend their diversity and to bring all things back again to a concept of unity. Thus, man, seeking for God, imposes unity, because within his own consciousness, he has the internal numerative power to recognize that deity is numeration and creation is number. And therefore, to discover number is to observe diversity. To experience numeration is to recognize that all diversities are parts of unity. And therefore, he can intellectually conceive unity. This is also referred to as archetypal mentation, or the power to perceive patterns through things. The things themselves are arranged by the orderly powers of consciousness into patterns, and the discovery of these patterns is a series of experiences in consciousness, which may be defined as apperception, or intuitive realization, or if extended to a sufficiently high level of experience, may properly be termed illumination, or a mystical ecstasis, which is the experience of a numerative power uniting all things inwardly and eternally, although they may not be so united when explored or examined by the sensory powers of man. This brings us again to another Pythagorean theorem, and that is the statement of the pentagram. Now, the pentagram, or pentalpha, as it was called by the Pythagoreans, was the symbol of healing. And Pythagoras is said to have worn upon his finger a ring ornamented with a five-pointed star, this star being composed of a continuous, unbroken line forming this pentagonal figure. Now, the five, of course, represents the sensory powers of man. For the ancients recognized five operative sensory perceptions and two latent ones. The two latent ones, however, arising from the perfection or development of the five lesser. Now, as these five senses which man possesses are in themselves separate, they may be likened to five sticks, or five of anything. But when they are united by the numerative power of the soul, they become a new thing. They become the pentagon, or they become the pentad, which is a unity. And when the faculties of man are united in this state of indivisible unity to form a new kind of thing, a new faculty. This becomes, through the Greek, the apperceptive faculty, which is born from the chemistry of the union of the five sensory powers, but is itself a sixth power, or one which is totality. And this sixth power immediately assumes the proportion of unity, and is therefore capable of the true perception, or true examination of phenomena. Because it is this power added to the five, which permits the five senses to perceive all things as unity, rather than as diversity when reported by their separate powers. This day we see then that there are a great many different ways in which the Pythagorean arithmetic becomes a key to a study and theory and logic and reason in many different branches of human experience. Now we have another interesting and important thought here, and this is Aristotle's system of what he calls converging nullities. Now these terms are a little more dangerous by sound than they are by fact, so we just suggest that you pass over the terms, and I use them merely for convenience in reference, in case you just want to check with some standard work on mathematical philosophy. But the system of converging nullities is a very simple thing, in fact, and that is by use of fractions. In the use of fractions, you can arrive at 9/10 of totality, or you can arrive at 99/100 of totality, or 999,000 of totality, or 9,999,000 of totality. But in your system of fractions, you are always going to fall short of totality. Now, the interesting point is that the further you carry this series of converging nullities, the nearer you come to totality, but you can never reach it. Actually, 9,900 is nearer totality than 9/10. And because 9/10 is only 90/100. And so on. But if you go into the most inconceivable sum that you can possibly imagine by this fractional process of convergence, you will still lack something. You will always lack one part of the total fraction. In 9/10, you lack 1/10. In 9,900, you lack 100. In 999,000, you lack 1,000. So if you go on far enough, it will seem as though you should be able to drift to totality, but you can never do it, because there will always be one lacking. And here Pythagoras used this to represent another way of approaching the concept of the numerative soul. For this missing unit, or this missing fractional unit, always represents that which falls short of totality. And yet, wherever it is imposed in any of its strength or of weight, it immediately consummates totality. Therefore, unity as a concept or as a numerative principle added to any deficient thing creates totality. Thus it becomes a kind of negative representation. That does not say that God and one is a majority, but rather says that any number plus God is totality. And this becomes a curious concept, because one, in this case, also represents the principle of indivisible unity, which imposed at the end of all diversity will restore unity. Now, Pythagoras pointed this out in a very interesting analogy, which has very practical consideration for us. Namely, that man may gradually grow upward from various percentages He may grow from one half to two thirds to three quarters to four fifths to five sixths and so on to infinity. But he will always fall short one of totality. He cannot reach it on the fractional basis without the addition of totality. And this totality implies to Pythagoras that man, through intellection, through growth, through study, through science, philosophy, art, music, literature, may gradually reduce the interval between himself and totality. But the final consummation of totality is the bestowal of grace by God itself, which is the missing number, which cannot be supplied by the fractional part, but must be bestowed. Therefore, the totality, which represents the completion of any task, like the mysterious missing capstone of the pyramid, you can build as far as you want to remember, but you must always have the concept of the divine number, or the divine power one, added to any of your works before that work can be perfect. This he developed quite extensively, but I think for our purposes, that will carry the general thought and give you the principle upon which this operates. Now, we also have another group of numbers. In fact, there are probably 200 or 300 of these number pattern groups. We cannot touch them all, we won't try. But we will try to point out a few to give you the general picture of the implications of this extraordinary philosophical speculation. We find, therefore, among the Pythagoreans, what was called the sieve of Eratosthenes, the sieve of the numbers. For as a sieve allows certain small materials to pass through, but blocks and stops larger materials than can pass through the sieve, so there was a mathematical sieve by which all numbers were inevitably divided into three kinds: perfect numbers, superabundant numbers, and deficient numbers. Now, perfect numbers are the rarest, inasmuch as the perfect number becomes the symbol of absolute equilibrium. There is only one perfect number between 1 and 10. One perfect number between 10 and 100. One perfect number between 100 and 1,000. One between 1,000 and 10,000. One between 10,000 and 100,000. One between 100,000 and 1,000,000. And so on. In each of these major divisions, there is only one perfect number. The simplest and most common of the perfect numbers is the number 6, which is the number between 1 and 10. The reason why the number 6 is termed a perfect number is because the sum of its parts is equal to itself. A half of 6 is 3, a third of 6 is 2, a sixth of 6 is 1, and 3, 2, and 1 equals 6. Now, those are the only possible divisions that can be made, equal divisions, that can be made of that number. And the sum of the parts equals the number. Therefore, this is termed a perfect number. 8, for example, can only be divided in certain ways. A half of 8 is 4, a fourth of 8 is 2, and an eighth of 8 is 1, which makes 7. Therefore, this is a deficient number, because the sum of its parts is less than the number itself. We take the number 12, for example. A half of 12 is 6. A fourth of 12 is 3. A third of 12 is 4. A sixth of 12 is 2. And a twelfth of 12 is 1. The sum of these is greater than 12. Therefore, this is a superabundant number. Now, in this problem, superabundant and deficient numbers are comparatively common. And the reason that Pythagoras made use of this particular calculation is to exemplify, in part, the importance of equilibrium in the achievement of human consciousness. Therefore, according to the Pythagoreans, where the parts are in excess of the totality, we have a superabundant number. Where they are deficient of the totality, we have a deficient number. Now, this has to do with the power of the numerative soul to control the totality. Because with the exception of one class of numbers, the numerative soul in man is not capable of controlling all parts. And those parts which are not controlled are called deficient numbers, are called superabundant numbers. Those in which the control is unable to map the lesser part, and the totality is therefore hypothetical in the presence of a power not properly developed or organized, we have a deficient number. But where the parts and the whole are equal, we then have a true number or a perfect number. And the study of arts and sciences particularly has to do with this. Because, for example, if the teacher does not know enough, he is a deficient number. If, on the other hand, the teacher, knowing much, does not take into consideration the ignorance of the student, he is a superabundant number. Because the totality of what he has to give cannot be received. Whereas if the teacher and the pupil have a full and complete understanding, and that the student receives all that he is capable of receiving, and the teacher judiciously gives that which the student can use, the result is a perfect number. Therefore, the relationship between man and the world, a phenomenon, is here indicated. The individual who sees less than there is to see is functioning with a deficient numerative power. If he sees more than he can understand, and surrounded with wonders, comprehends nothing, then there is a superabundant number, because his total integration does not permit him to understand that which he sees. There are hundreds of applications of the principle, but this is the basis upon which the concept was built. And of course, each of the numbers involved in these patterns has its own significance. That is a very big subject, because each one of these numbers is made up of a certain combination of numbers. And these, in turn, like the elements in a chemical compound, each has a distinct meaning. And from these distinct meanings, we have a great deal. For instance, the number 6, which is the first of the perfect numbers, is also in the Pythagorean concept the number of marriage, because it represents the basic unity of divided parts. The number 6 being the proper symbol of union, and therefore it is a perfect number, because it encloses or concludes a totality. And of course, the 3 divided parts of the number, the half being 3, the third being 2, and the sixth being 1, becomes the basic family unit, father, mother, child. And the same number on the level of the universe is related to the days of creation, and the 3 equal parts, which total to itself, are the 3 persons of the Trinity. Every part of this numerical system becomes extremely complicated, but out of it, almost anything that you wish to conceive and rationalize and understand can be developed, so that it becomes a magnificent system of theology as well as a system of science. And that is one of the things we feel so badly about in connection with modern education, because the advanced books of Euclid are largely devoted to the great numerical speculations of Pythagoras. And yet the entire books of Euclid are not available to the average student, and the so-called Euclidean mathematics that we have merely carries us through those primary parts which are concerned in barter exchange, architecture, and things of that nature, and give us no concept of the great philosophy of numbers with which Euclid himself was well familiar and which he attempted to develop in his more advanced works, which are not even available to the public in general today. So the mathematical subject becomes a very much bigger one when we first realize or understand. Now, out of this problem also, we come to what has been termed the motion of numbers, which is one of our primary considerations this evening, so we're going to have to take more time with it. I wanted to try and sort of sprinkle in a little bit of Pythagorean thinking, so you'd have some grasp of the field of his mind and how the mathematical philosophy developed. Now, the motion of number is either from 1 to 10 or from arithmetic to geometry. The ancients reasoned, therefore, that on a horizontal plane, the numbers unfolded from 1 to 10. On a vertical plane, they fell from arithmetic to geometry. And this double motion of number became very, very important in their philosophy. Now, Pythagoras, like all the ancients, began the entire concept of mathematical philosophy with the hypothetical dot. The dot, or point, is the beginning of all form, all numeration, and all motion. The dot itself is the principle of numeration. And the circle is the circumference of number. Therefore, the dot precedes, and the circle terminates. The dot precedes the descent from arithmetic to geometry, and the circle consummates the extent or extension of our numbers from the 1 to the 10, or the cycle, the complete cycle of numbers. Thus, in a sense, the circle is an exoteric dot, and a dot is an exoteric circle. The dot is archetypal. The circle exists in the sphere of creation. Therefore, it is customary to conceive of total being as a dot, and of total existence as a circle. And the dot placed in the circle is being in the center of existence, or being in the center of the cycle or circle of its own field, or its own extension into totality. In the Hebrew Kabbalah, the dot and the circle are placed in the form of a human eye. The opened eye being the symbol of manifestation, and the closed eye being the symbol of the universe in absentia, or in suspension, in the divine mind. Therefore, creation was represented in the Kabbalah by the opening of the eye of the Great One, or the Great Being, which immediately revealed the mysterious mathematical form of the dot and the circle, or the central point of the eye in the field of the iris. Now, the dot, by motion, can move only from itself. It can never approach itself, because it is hypothetically forever centered. Therefore, the only possible motion of a dot is away from itself. And this motion is called a line. And the most primary of all lines is the number 1, which is the first vertical drop of the dot. The dot descending from its own state into the circumference of the circle first produces a line, which hypothetically becomes the radius of the circle also. But the dot extending itself away from itself creates the line, which is the most simple of all the basic mathematical forms, and the line itself becomes 1. Now the line, moving away from itself, can produce only another manifestation. For a line moving from itself produces a circuit, because all of the line has to move. And the line moving away from itself causes a flat surface. Therefore, this is the second, or area. And this area sets aside a certain level called a plane and becomes the basis of a different level or concept of existence. And when the surface moves away from itself, it can move in only the one direction. The whole surface must move. Therefore, a surface moving away from itself produces a solid. And there we have the fall of arithmetic into geometry. And the solid, the most simple of all mathematical solids, is the tetrahedron, or the four-faced symmetrical solid composed of each face of a triangle. This is the smallest number of faces that can enclose an area. Therefore, if you will consider carefully your mythological and your religious systems throughout the world, you will realize that the number 4 is always very closely associated with the concept of God. Now, the concept of God, in this sense, is the concept of what the ancients called the demiurgus, or the creating deity. In other words, the God in creation and of creation. The God that moves upon the face of the deep. Deity in the sense of a creating power, which is not absolute deity or absolute being represented for the God. This is deity moving into quantitative and qualitative manifestation. Qualitative manifestation being determined by the geometrical solid, and quantitative manifestation by the extension of the numbers from 1 to 10. Now there is a large thought hiding in this pattern, a very large one. And it involves a number of very interesting and remarkable fields of research. For example, the number 4 is an even number composed of even numbers, 2 2. It can also be composed of a 1 and a 3, which gives us 2 possible forms by which the 4 can be fashioned. Going back to our other theory that we just had, if we take 4, a half of 4 is 2, a fourth of 4 is 1, the sum is 3, which makes the 4 a deficient number. You have to begin to work these systems in and with each other. Therefore, we recognize that the ancients understood the 4 as the symbol of creation, of the objectification of the material universe as the 4 elements, and as the great field of form generation. Therefore, the number 4 is the archetypal number of form, and the concept of form and the solid, the leaf of the solid form, gives us form and solid as being identical in concept. Now we go to another interesting point, which is made for the Greeks and also has been made for the Hindus, and one that we are comparatively unaware of. Namely, that creation is a deficiency rather than an addition. Creation is not what we think it is. Creation is the addition or the manifestation of the greatest solidity existing within the greatest density. Now, the dot, or space, is the greatest density. Because space is absolute fullness. All conditions are less than that. Therefore, it is said in Egypt, and also among the Hindus, that when the time came to create the world, the Ammonian artificers, the Elohim of the Bible, took their knives and made holes in space. And forms are holes in space. And that is quite a problem, but it's an interesting one. Because density is a greater and more enduring thing than solidity. A rock is more solid than the air around it. But the air is more dense than the rock. And space, which permeates the rock, permeates the air, and permeates everything, is actual, more real, more enduring, more substantial than the rock. The proof of that is that the rock comes into being from space, abides for a time, and will ultimately return to space again. Every rock that ever existed was once in space, invisible. And every form, every world, every planet, every solar system, which appears as a solid form, is a solidity emanating from density. And everything that exists is ultimately going to disappear again. And when it disappears, it passes from a state of solidity to a state of density. And when it reaches the state of density, it reaches the state of permanence. Because density is eternal. Solidity is not. Anything that is solid is a compound. And as Lord Bacon put on his own gravestone, all compounds shall be dissolved. Therefore, actually, ignorance is a whole in truth. It is like an opening or an empty place. Form is a whole in space. Because in form, eternity is privated. As the Pythagoreans say, the universe was formed by the divine power retiring from the circumference to the center of itself and leaving a vacuum. This would seem exactly the opposite. There are certain metaphysical groups that seem to be, appear to be here, but we're not really here at all. And it would be rather embarrassing to realize or to have the thought that we really hold in the air and not here at all. And we're not going to go to any such extreme as that, you know, or anything of that nature. But qualitatively, the state of separate existence is less than the state of total existence. Therefore, every separate thing is inferior to totality. And as all created things are separate things, it is inevitable that their quality is less than that of totality. Therefore, they are a conditioned existence existing within an unconditioned state. And that conditioned existence is inferior to the unconditioned state. Therefore, in terms of exact definition, things are less than that no thing which is their common source. And things are not an abundance of things. They are a deficiency of things. And that is why you have to add them all together before you can get one. In other words, if we were positive beings, then if you added us all together, you would get many. But when we are deficient beings, it is necessary for us all to be added together to neutralize or compensate for the deficiency. If each individual was a plus in an atmosphere which was a minus, he would then be complete in himself. But as it so happens in the universe, if you add all existence together, the sum is space. Therefore, each existence must be less than space, or be deficient. This is one of the reasons why we fill up the vacuum by coming together. And when we have all come together, then we have neutralized and have created, again, the fact of space. This underlies the Buddhist concept of nirvana also, which is not the loss of something in the unknown, but rather the loss of that which is not in the totality of that which is. No thing then can cease, except in the sense of its return to its own totality. And because our sensory perceptions are incapable of the concept or vision or sensing of totality, that which passes from a fractional condition toward a unity passes out of the contemplative range of man, and therefore is said to disappear or to no longer have existence. On this theme, of course, you could do a great deal in the Pythagorean speculation. You could have really quite a holiday working with this phase of the Pythagorean mathematics. This brings us to another point that we have to dwell on for a moment, and that is the great symbol of the Pythagorean school, which was the tetractys. Now, the tetractys is a pyramid of dots, consisting of four rows of dots. The first row with one dot, the second row with two dots, the third with three dots, and the fourth with four dots. And these are arranged in the form of an equilateral triangle with the apex at the top. Now this system or sequence of dots, according to the Pythagorean theory, was the perfect symbol of the numerative soul of space, because within this design was bound up all the mystery of numbers, and the tetrapsis itself was the totality which constituted the soul image or pattern. The tetrapsis was the symbol of the perfect ensoulment of the number by archetype. And as it was equilateral, it could be approached from any direction. And because it was an equilateral triangle, it was one fourth part of the pentagon, or four-sided symmetrical solid. The Pythagoreans used what was called the greater and the lesser tetrapsis. The concept was later borrowed by the Kabbalists, who involved it in the structure of the Sephirotic tree, or the ten mysterious blossoms upon the tree of life, by which they represented all the world, creation, all the patterns of existence. Now, the total of 1, 2, 3, and 4 is, of course, 10. And therefore, these dots complete the decimal unit. And the Pythagoreans tell them in their various combinations in the greatest and the most profound regard. They became a pyramid of number. The pyramidal form, pyramidal form itself, being the form of the Greek letter D or delta, which in itself is the first letter of the name of deity. So that there was an additional importance in the form itself. The Hebrew mystics took the same design, and instead of the dot, they used little marks resembling commas, which were the Hebrew letters Yod, the most sacred or fire letter, the Hebrew letter which peculiarly symbolized spirit and life. Later, the tetrapsis was used also cabalistically in connection with the tetragrammaton, or the four-letter name of God, which we pronounce Jehovah, which is composed in the Hebrew of four letters, I-H-D-H. Therefore, in arranging the dots, they placed the I on the first line, I-H on the second line, I-H-V on the third line, and I-H-D-H on the fourth line. Letting one of these letters, therefore, represent each of the dots. From this, they form also an equilateral triangle. In this sense, composed of the name of God. And the most important of the names for deity to be found in the Kabbalistic system. A word which is not usually spoken by an Orthodox Jew. When he reads it in the Bible or comes across it in sacred writings, he substitutes the word Adonai, or Elohim, to signify Lord or Lord of hosts. He does not use the word itself, because to him it is a sacred and secret name. The basic Hebrew alphabet is composed of tiny comma-like marks, which are called planes. And in all probability, the original forms were taken from star groups. And these form the handwriting on the wall of heaven, and the mesoretic dots, or points, or diacritical marks, which were added, represented the motion of the planets through the signs of the constellations, thus spelling out words or giving new meaning to the continental group. So in the Hebrew mysticism, and in the Greek also, we find the tremendous importance, kabbalistically and magically, of this mysterious symbol, the symbol of the tetrapsis. Now, the tetrapsis arranges the dots, therefore, upon four levels. The first level having only one dot, the second level two, the third level three, and the lower level four. Thus, there is an automatic division into four rows of dots, of which the first row, of course, contains only the single dot. Also, in arranging these dots, a certain number of intervals come into existence. The spaces between dots. And it is relating to the problem of intervals that we have the motion of number. Because motion is always motion through or across intervals. and everything that exists in interval. And in the study of philosophy, we become gradually more and more conscious of interval and less conscious of incident. Incident is to us formal, relating to solidity. Interval is non-formal and relates to the principle of density. Therefore, solidity moving through density is thing moving through interval. Now, the example of this on a practical level can be taken from the philosophy of history. We have, for example, historical incidents. We know when Columbus discovered America. We know that there is nothing less important than the memorization of that date. We know 1492, but it means nothing apart from context. The fact that in 1066 William the Conqueror stubbed his toe on the soil of England is also a magnificently unimportant fact. And this gives us what the Pythagoreans expressed as the danger or menace of fact. Because all facts are static. The spaces between them are dynamic. All things, therefore, are in themselves factual. The intervals between them are susceptible of something greater than fact. For a fact is different from a truth, and a truth is different from a reality. Consequently, when we study history, or we take words, it is not the words themselves, but their arrangement that becomes necessary through the transference of ideas. And this means that some people with a very large vocabulary never say anything. And some of the greatest teachers of English in the world have never had a thought. They have a magnificent instrument, but they've never used it. Because the fact or the substances themselves are meaningless unless you put them to work. And a thing to work must have space to work in. And space is interval. You cannot get a carpenter to work unless he has elbow room. He has to have space. And space requires motion and implies it. And all action implies the need for space in which to move. And of course, this we can't help but remember at this time, one of the test problems of ancient knowledge. If you can solve it, why, you're very good. One man by the name of Euclid, not our friend the mathematician, but another Euclid, which is a common name in Greece in those days, is said to have committed suicide over this problem, the problem of motion. He said, for a thing to move, it must pass from the place where it is to the place where it is not. And as all things must be inevitably in the places where they are, can anything move? That thought cost him his life. He was never able to solve the mystery. What he did not have as probably possessed was the Pythagorean realization that the motion of the dot produces the line. Therefore, things can move. And yet, the motion of the dot in producing the line does not take the dot away from where it is. It merely extends the dot into a dimension. And this dimension, in turn, is the principle of motion. Now, to return for a moment to the problem of history. History is significant only because of perspective upon a problem. History is a point. Now is a point. Now is a point of importance because of two intervals represented by two other hypothetical dots. So on one side of now is a dot which is called the past. And on the other side of now is a dot which is called the future. And between the past and the present is an interval. And between the present and the future is an interval. Now our estimation of value forces us to bridge the interval between the past and the present, and leads us inevitably by the imaginative power of the mind to bridge the interval from the present to the future in the terms of the preceding interval.